basically all injuries are due to repetitive stress. I mean, if you don't stress yourself, you're never going to get hurt. But again, if you don't stress yourself, you're going to deteriorate and die also.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Faith Goss.
And I'm Scott War.
Scott's joining us today as virtual Scott. He's actually, where are you, Scott?
I'm in Fresno, California.
Fresno, California, and joins us via Skype and FaceTime. So we're combining two technologies today. And we We don't really have any business using one technology. But we're also happy to have Dr. Mark Cucuzella, who is our trail doctor, and he joins us from his home. Well, you're not even at home either, are you, Scott? Mark, where are you?
I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania right now.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but home is where Two River Treads Running Store is in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, where Dr. Cucuzella practices as a physician, helping people with their health care. He also can be found at trtreads.org, which is the website to Two Rivers Treads Running Store. NaturalRunningCenter.com. I love to give all this stuff up front because I've spent a lot of time researching and looking at all the great articles that are on there and videos and everything that's there. It's made me fall behind on a few projects of my own. You can find there a 72-page booklet, Injury-Free Running, How to Become a More Efficient and Faster Running. If you just sign up for the newsletter, you have access to that. And Dr. Mark is a runner himself, as you know, that this is his third podcast with us. And he's a 238 marathoner. He's a trail runner. He has the answers for us. He talks about the economy of running, and we are absolutely excited about running economy.
Definitely.
Welcome, Dr. Mark.
Well, thank you, Scott, Faith, and Don. It's always a pleasure to be back chatting with you guys. I think we have good, fun conversations, even though we, you know, maybe pose more questions than we answer during the conversations, but that's a good thing.
Hey, well, that's how we get you back, is we have to leave a few questions lingering so we can have an excuse to call you. Tell us a little bit about this shoeseum. I see on your website something about a shoeseum. What is that, Dr. Mark?
Yeah, so we've always wanted, and we're almost to the point of getting it put up and done. So we want to be able to kind of tell a little bit of the history of running and running shoes through kind of a visual in our store. You know, so a museum, you kind of have history of whatever it is that you want to be looking at or learning from. But there's a lot to learn from just the history of shoes, which tell a larger story than just shoes. You talk about the people of the time. You talk about how people ran, how people trained. But I think you can see everything right now is kind of, you know, back to the future, you know, meaning we're going back to what we knew to be true 50 years ago. So nothing's new under the sun in a shoeseum. All the newest and best shoes now look pretty much exactly like they did in the late 60s. So to show that kind of progression and return is, I think, a nice story to tell.
We've made a full circle, if you will.
You know, like you know, right now, you know, your mother may say, well, maybe you should eat vegetables. You know, and when you were a kid, you ate vegetables. And then, like, at some point in middle life, we all ate processed crap. And now we're like, oh, well, vegetables and roots are good for you. But, you know, your grandmother told you that 80 years ago. And now it's like new age organic stuff.
I think same I'm still thing. In the processed food category.
Yeah, I got all these guys in the store, like, you know, I'll eat whatever I can, you know, fit in my mouth into, like, raw food and all. But, you know, I'm learning it again. You know, if I had time to shop for all that, I'd probably be a healthier person. But I think we all need to make the effort to do that because it is important, you know, especially if you have kids, you know, setting the example and eating well and just living well, even if it takes a little more effort.
Mm-hmm. What food group are the Cheetos Puffs in? You know, those really
I don't
curly.
Know about those Cheetos Puffs. The whole grain Cheetos Puffs.
Oh, yeah.
No, the ones that explode cheese flavor in your mouth when you bite into them. Yes. That's the one I want to know.
Hot Cheetos.
I haven't broken that one down in the lab yet.
Well, certainly it's probably on some type of do not eat list somewhere in the food manifest that we read. You know,
it'd be one of those foods you could put out on your shelf, and then 20 years later, it would still look the same.
I was gonna say that, like the Big Mac experiment they have going on in some doctor's offices. I'll see that. I'm like, how old is that? And they're like, well, how old do you think it is? I'm like, I don't know, like one or two. And they're like, that's 7 years old.
They have that really thing?
Yeah. They have like a hamburger and fries.
He was a science teacher in New York, and he retired a few years ago. And he told this story, you know, 30 years before his retirement was when the Twinkie came out. And one of his students asked him, well, how, you know, this was when preservatives, this was a new age thing, preservatives. So they asked him, well, how long would this thing preserve? So he put it on his chalkboard. And then he retired 30 years later, and it still looked the same.
Yikes.
It's kind of scary. It had a little dust on it, but it still looked like a Twinkie. So
it's true. It's scary.
It's true.
Here's
it's
a question.
USA Today, so it's true.
Yeah. Here's a question for you. Do you think these foods may contribute to our topic that we're talking about, the cumulative trauma injury as it relates to running? Do you think eating some of these foods may contribute to some injury?
I totally think so. And if you really want to read a guy who I think honestly has done his homework and understands macro and micronutrients, his name is Dr. Steve Gengemi. He's the Sock Doc, and he's been on your show.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I mean, our body's injuries really stem from what's called inflammation. And inflammation is caused by many things, but the diet affects our body's healing response. So if you're eating well, sleeping well, you know, in a stress-free state, you know, you're not developing this negative inflammatory response. So, I mean, all of us that at some point in our lives are busy with either our running life, we know that if we sleep better and eat better, we just somehow adapt to that. And I know it myself because I don't eat, you know, I think the guy wrote a book, you know, there's a book called Younger Next Year, and his name is Harry Lodge, and he had a chapter on eating well, but basically it was summarized in one sentence, don't eat crap. Yeah, and he's, you know, you could read the
right?
rest of the chapter, but you know that kind of summed it up. But yeah, so we do recover better if we eat foods that have the true micro and macronutrients we need. So you need proteins, fats, carbohydrates, but there are specific micronutrients that are going to help, you know, the more stress you put on yourself. So yeah, I think it's an everything thing. So how do you recover and not get injured? It's not just about training effects. Because you really recover and improve by how you rest, not how you train. That's how you recover and improve.
Well, there's a little golden nugget right there.
Well, yeah, so if you're sleeping in, you know, missing your training run, just tell your friend, look, I'm training.
I've used that a few times.
Yeah, look, I'm letting yesterday's workout really reap its benefits in bed. You know?
On the subject of nutrition, how about all of these energy drinks that people are slamming down almost as a constant part of their diet? What are your thoughts on that?
Diet. Oh my gosh, yeah. So I mean, no kidding. I'm like anyone else. I need a cup of coffee in the morning. Caffeine does a lot of good things, but these sugar-loaded energy drinks with ephedra, you know, I mean, as a physician, you know, they've actually banned them from the military stores because there are a number of deaths, you know, that they attributed to these drinks, you know, to the point that they took them out of all the BX, PX stores and all the Department of Defense stores because these young kids were like, heard that these things were good for them, would go pop, you know, 16 rock stars and then go hit the gym, you know, and it's laced with ephedra, which is high potency stimulant. Not the caffeine. We're talking the ephedra. So those things are just bad news. So I would just leave it at that. You do not need them. Need a little caffeine. It's been around for millennia. That's okay. We know it's safe.
You know, that's a really good point because I've even seen in these ultra races where people are popping Red Bulls, you know, at aid stations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and again, they're in a competition, and you know, they're, you know, I'm a Air Force flight doc by trade, and we have a what we call go and no go pills. So if you're flying a long mission and you're just done and you're going to send your plane to the ground, we have specific things that are regulated, they're allowed to take, as long as they've tested them before on the ground. Okay, you need to stay awake. Here's plan A, caffeine. Plan B, I can't tell you what that is. Plan C, can't tell you what that is. But these are higher potency things that you would use operationally, yeah, to save your butt so you don't fly your plane into the ground. So if you're at that stage, you know, an ultra marathon is not a healthy experience. You know, if for some reason you're putting yourself through something because you want to, because you trained for it and you had a goal. So you may do something out of the box that one day, but you know that's not healthy. But I would recommend this. Don't do anything new. Like, don't say, well, I've never taken a Red Bull or a Rockstar, but someone told me it's good at mile 30, so let me just try it. You know, ground test it first in a controlled situation, because it could totally wig you out the other way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get your heart rate up 30 beats, and that's probably not good for your, you know, the physiology of an ultra, which is tapping into fat burning. If you just ramped up your heart rate into to the fight or flight response, you've just done the opposite. So practice, like anything. If you're going to take a gel or a peanut butter sandwich, don't let that be the first one you've ever taken, you know, during your ultra aid station, because it's there. Practice it, mm-hmm. rehearse it.
So many of the, we're, our topic today, and the fun thing about Dr. Mark is you don't even have to have a topic. You just have to get him on the phone and start talking. But we would want to talk a little bit about cumulative trauma injury, repetitive injury. As runners, we take a lot of steps. You know, what there's 1,400 steps in a mile. You know, depends on the length of your stride, but we do a lot of repetitive things out there. When you start putting miles upon miles on a training run, and then during a training week, we are susceptible to some repetitive type injury. And thought, who better to talk about these repetitive injuries than Dr. Cucuzzella? What's your take on these types of injuries, Doctor?
You know, I think, Don, I mean, that's basically all injuries are due to repetitive stress. I mean, if you don't stress yourself, you're never going to get hurt. But again, if you don't stress yourself, you're going to deteriorate and die also. So you have to apply some level. Yeah, it's true. So we're all in the middle somewhere. Too much stress, you die. No stress, you die. You know, if you just said, I'm going to go lay in bed and just see what happens, and then 3 weeks later, you've gone the other direction. So luckily, our bodies are biologic models, meaning we supercompensate, meaning if you apply the right amount of stress, again, in the sleep, you improve. So you improve by applying a stress and recovering, and you supercompensate. That's adaptation and a training effect. So you have to apply some stress or you'll never improve. Apply the same level of stress, you'll probably stay the same. Apply no stress and you go backwards.
Hmm.
So probably one phrase to keep in mind for the audience is, you know, maybe I don't know if we talked about this in one of the other podcasts, but you know, your body has what's called a load capacity curve. So if you apply a stress above your body's capacity to endure that stress, you're going to get hurt. So a training regimen is gradually increasing your capacity to sustain stress. So if you're a runner, and everyone knows this, that first day they ran, they went like 400 meters and it sucked. Now Faith is going to run 50 miles. I mean, think of where you are now compared to that first day you said, I want to go run for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's years and years and years of adapting that. And at some point you went over the curve and you didn't listen to that and you got hurt, and then come out the other end and you figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, your body will not, you know, adapt greater than the capacity it has to accept that stress. So every day, every week, apply it a little bit more. You know, if you feel like it's too much is going on that week, back off a little bit, recover. But you're trying to kind of what we call, you know, in exercise physiology, move the curve to the right. You're trying to have a progressive training effect with tissue stress and metabolic. you know, you're building aerobic capacity. So you're building everything at the same time. Most people just work on their engines, you know, work on their, you know, they run, but they don't understand the tissue stress. Mm-hmm. And they run for time and they're working their engine, but they don't understand the tissue principles involved, which is mostly connective tissue, fascia, which is where muscles connect to tendons. That's where people get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not listening to that.
What do you recommend, you say, to do a slow build and progressively add more miles or more time on your feet training? What is your suggestion of additional mileage?
Yeah, so it all goes back to what people knew years ago. So when Bill Bowerman wrote the book Jogging in 1967, the whole premise of that book, as was Ken Cooper's book Aerobics, was we want you to be your own coach. Every person has to understand intuitively how to be their own coach and listen to their body. This is what George Sheehan wrote about 40 years ago. Because if something is not feeling well, your body's telling you that area is not recovered. You know, you get these feedback. You know, I mean, one day you go out there and you feel like you've got a lot of pop in your legs and you feel fresh, and then the next day you don't.
Mm-hmm.
So back in the old days, runners figured out that they couldn't run hard every day. They just couldn't. And they didn't know the science behind that. They just knew that they couldn't. So they, when they were training, they could run fast one day, but the next day, and Frank Shorter tells us eloquently, he said the more that he did anaerobic work, the more he needed to do the slower work to sustain that. And they had what was called the lowest common denominator rule on their easy days. So they would meet as a group on the easy days, and whoever's running the slowest, they'd run with that person.
That's what Don does every time he runs with me.
Yeah, it's probably making you and Don better runners, but he needed to, because he's stressing that fascia tissue really hard on that day. He's running hard, and it takes 48 to 72 hours for tissue to repair. So if you're running hard every day, you're just breaking yourself down, and you're not allowing, this is just basic science that runners will never get, and they'll keep making the same mistakes until they just embrace it, that easy is for a purpose. So if you go out and run hard one day and you're a little bit sore, that's okay. But that next day, there's nothing called too easy. It is like today, for example, I went out, I'm doing Boston Marathon in 2 weeks. And yesterday I did about 16 miles and finished the run, probably the last 8 of it at 6 minutes per mile, which is like marathon pace. And that wasn't like all out hard, but it was a good effort. You know, I mean, that was not an easy run, but you know, feeling what a marathon pace would feel like. So today I went out with my dog and ran 40 minutes at like 15-minute miles and stopped at every place for her to sniff. But that was the purpose of my training today, was just mm-hmm. to go out and shake my legs out. And that was it. Done. I don't know what I'll do tomorrow. I'll see how I feel. But there was no like internal pressure that I'm supposed to run 8 miles at 8-minute pace or something today. No, the only purpose was to go out and get some blood back in my legs. So mm-hmm. yesterday, I don't waste... You know, if I had one last decent effort before the marathon that was supposed to make a training adaptation, how's my body going to feel at 6-minute pace? Let's stress it a little bit. But if I went out and ran today and didn't let that workout, you know, do what it was supposed to, I would have just wasted it completely and probably end up hurt and sore tomorrow.
You know, I mean,
that's really what it is.
Yeah, we call that out here, we have a little run that we call Mitochondria Monday, or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
We just go out there and try to build more engines within each cell.
Mitochondria.
Yeah, Mitochondria Monday it's called, and we do, the lowest common denominator. I'm not going to say who it is, but we bring somebody out there.
Every week.
Yeah, it depends who it is. Sometimes it's me, and we just get out there and just move along and have a great social time and one of the most enjoyable runs, because you're not, you know, stressing yourself out. Because running should be fun. This is our passion, and we should enjoy it. So you can't get back into the car every time shaking, going, gosh, I didn't have anything left. There are times for that, I think, and it's probably very good to stress ourselves at that level occasionally.
Donemeyer Mitochondrial Monday run tonight.
Actually, I was just about to say that's the only runs I get invited on anymore, and he puts me in front of the line.
Oh, okay. Hey, you know, you mentioned something a moment ago, Dr. Mark, about engines, running your engine, and you know, soft tissue, and I've had this thought for a while, and you're welcome to shoot it down because I can drop something if it doesn't fit, but I'm under the impression that cardiovascular, our lungs and our heart, and even our muscles, because they have a direct blood supply, can recover faster and build faster and rehab faster than, say, soft tissue of cartilage and tendons and the avascular structures.
Completely true. That is actually a great point. And that's why, you know, you look at all these studies that are done for 8 to 12 weeks. So if I took someone off of the couch and I wanted to make an immediate improvement for them in 8 weeks, they could go do anaerobic work. And this is the phase one adaptation, which is cardiac. So you increase, immediately you start to, if you take a sedentary person and you start to exercise them, you'll increase cardiac contractility, cardiac output. Mm-hmm. So they will get better. And if you do high intensity work, they'll make that adaptation real quick. But that's not a long-term adaptation. So in 8 weeks, if I took someone and said, let's do the happy run plan, let's go Lydiard pace, let's go real slow and easy and start building mitochondria and capillaries and all that stuff, you know, that's a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year process. But if I want to try to get the most bang for the buck quickly, do some interval training and you make that cardiorespiratory adaptation quickly. But that is limited. You're done at 6 to 8 weeks. But if you want to get healthier, and then you lose it because you haven't made any real metabolic adaptation. It's all cardiovascular. But long-term adaptation is metabolic, capillaries, mitochondria, like you said, Mitochondrial Monday. So that takes, you know, why does a Kenyan kid come out and run a 210 marathon without, quote, training? Is because they've basically been running around their entire life building all, they're not doing high intensity interval training, they're just running to school, but they've built the pyramid from the bottom up, not the top down, so it's got a base to stay on.
Yeah,
but what you say is true. I mean, that's just, I don't really care what any 6 week study shows me on exercise, because none of us plan to be here just for 6 weeks.
And so as people are increasing their training, I think that's at least my thought, is that you just need to be cognizant of the fact that you can ramp up quicker on the engine than you can on some of the supporting structure, the frame around that engine. And then people end up with medial knee pain or shin splints or things of that, where the connective tissue is holding us together versus the the propulsion system.
Yeah, and that's true. So there's the metabolic and the connective tissue also. So it takes, you know, to really, when you look at injuries, you know, I kind of look at it this way. You've got to develop a coordination of movement before you can add strength and power. So people really need to learn. Everyone right now is interested in the quantity of movement, not the quality of movement, where everyone's adding quantity, 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 but not really focusing on quality. So they want to do a specific time or goal or pace. And ultimately it cracks because they haven't really worked on the quality of movement first. So if you're not doing a movement correctly, you start doing thousands and thousands and thousands of reps. Yeah, ultimately you're going to develop some break in the ring. You know, somewhere there's going to be tissue trauma that you're not going to adapt to. But it, you know, again, if you don't, it's all how much you run. I mean, all running injuries have to do to some cumulative stress. If you don't run that much, you're not going to get hurt, and you can do things incorrectly, and that's okay. You're probably still getting fit, you know, to a point. But
yeah,
for, you know, Faith's doing a 50 miler, you got to, you know, it's a little more than that. You got to do it correct.
Yeah. And I think an excellent place for those listening to the podcast, an excellent place to start learning how to have that quality versus quantity, making that shift. Dr. Mark has put out some really great videos that are available. We've linked them to our previous podcast and they're on the Natural Running Center website. But my question for you involves, how do we recognize those symptoms of the foreboding cumulative trauma injuries? What are some of the early warning signs we can kind of look for?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think people kind of ignore these warning signs. So if you look at when you wake up in the morning, so most injuries are not in the muscles, they're in the fascia, which is the connective tissue. You know, most of the running injuries are going to be, you know, if you went out and sprinted without warming up, yeah, you may rip your hammy in half, you know, something like that. But most of the time it's plantar fasciosis, Achilles tendinosis, anterior knee pain. They're these more microtrauma level things,
mm-hmm.
and most of them in connective tissue. So if you're waking up in the morning and you're just feeling stiff, mm-hmm. you know, you're feeling just gluey, that means you have inflammation in those areas. Now, the fascia should move freely like vermicelli noodles. If you lined up, you know, a couple hundred vermicelli noodles all aligned,
uh-huh.
you know, they're all going to kind of glide nice and smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if those things are overstressed, they're going to be like you've thrown them all on the floor, and they're all kind of gummed up. And everyone who wakes up in the morning who has plantar fasciitis or Achilles tendinosis knows this. It's like those first steps are really uncomfortable because all that tissue is kind of gumming up, and it's got to like loosen up. So if you're not waking up with a pop in your legs, you know, that's telling you that day, and this is, you know, I'm 45 now, and, you know, I don't run marathons as fast as I did in my younger years, but I'm trying to get the most out of what I got left, is if I'm not waking up and feeling that nice springy pop in my legs, I ain't even going to try to run fast that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it goes back to one of the terms Don used a few minutes ago, was just play. So, I think of, you know, at my age, every run is some form of what we call fartlek,
mm-hmm.
which at an essence is play, which has no outcome. Play by definition has no outcome. It's just being in the moment and enjoying.
Mm-hmm.
So Arthur Lydiard defined fartlek, and if you go to the Natural Running Center, I wrote an article on this. It's on the front page now. It's called The Lost Art of Fartlek. Mm-hmm. So there's two types of fartlek. You know, one is the traditional Swedish fartlek, which involves speeding and sprinting and jumping. But, you know, you had to just feel it and do it if it felt good. But then Arthur Lydiard developed what was called New Zealand fartlek because he was rehabilitating cardiac patients. But he knew the fun needed to be there, but he didn't want them sprinting up hills. So he said, you guys and gals, just go run easy and have a conversation. We call this New Zealand fartlek,
mm-hmm.
which is easy running.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, every run you do should be a fartlek. Meaning it should feel good and it should be happy. Now that day I love the days I have spring in my legs,
mm-hmm.
and I see a hill and I feel like sprinting up it, I'll go sprint up that hill. But if I don't feel that spring in my legs, it's not like, man, today's speed work day, because there is no such thing as speed work day. Nothing is work. It's all the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's work, I ain't doing it.
You know, I
agree.
Now, if I wanted to win a gold medal at a certain point, those people need to work because they have a different goal than you or I do. We're out there for health, not to, you know, end game. I'm supposed to hit this one time. I mean, who cares?
So going back to the inflammation phrase that really stuck with me after I asked that question about recognizing the symptoms and the noodles and feeling stiff. So what I'm going through right now is that feeling you get when you're going through a taper, where the other day I woke up and I've just been, you know, gradually decreasing my miles to get ready for the weekend ahead. And I just got out of bed and I was like, man, I feel old. Like, I feel stiff. Like, I just felt kind of achy, and you get those like phantom pains. Is it that I've been going so hard for so many months and now I'm finally tapering and my body's experiencing inflammation from the letdown? Like, what is going on?
Yeah, and everyone asks that question, and you know, I'm in 2 weeks out from the Boston Marathon, so I'm cutting back too. You just got to trust and believe in what you did. So do not lose faith in what you did, you know, because no kidding, you got 50 miles to figure it out. History is loaded with these types of experiences. So someone came to me and said, I've got a race in 2 weeks. What's your best advice? I'd say take 2 weeks off.
You bet.
I mean, that's like you read through history, or like, you know, Kenny Moore wrote in the Bowerman book, he, you know, set his 2-mile record because Bowerman knew he was overtraining, and he had spies out to make sure that for 2 weeks he said, Kenny, you cannot run more than 12 minutes at this pedestrian pace. If I catch you doing it, you're cut from the team. And, you know, so he was trying to sneak out and get more miles in, but eventually he knew that it probably wasn't a good idea. He'd get cut. So he kind of trusted his coach, and he went out and he set the collegiate record for 2 miles. You know, and Ambie Burfoot writes it in his book too, where he was coming off of like an injury and he took like 2 weeks off. And then he came out and he like set his PR in some distance. So yeah, just enjoy it. Don't stress it.
And trust yourself.
I think some people kind of like try to change too many things. You know, they're like, well, I've got to like carbo load for 2 months or something.
Yeah.
That's why I started running.
Yeah. Don't like change 50 things. Just slow your, like, if you have a 50 miler on Saturday, Faith, is that the day of the race?
Yeah.
And today's Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Just enjoy your week.
No, I'm,
you know, walk the dog and eat healthy, but don't overeat.
Yeah,
that's not going to do you any good. Just be normal.
I am, if you listen to some of our, I think it was like the first podcast I did, I talked about how freaky ritualistic I am when it comes to preparing for races. I don't change anything. Everything's the same. My eating, my drinking, what I wear. I'm very ritualistic how I go about preparing.
You know, Dr.
That has a comfort place too. You know, the night before, you know, you put your gear out, you know, put the number on, put it, because you're going to be like half zoned when you wake up, you know, just so you can, you know, Josh Cox calls it the invisible man thing. Like, he'll put everything out like there's an invisible man there, and, you know, just so you don't have anything to think about that morning, you know, just grab your cup of coffee, put your stuff on. You don't have to go rummage through stuff. It's all right there, and takes that pressure off your brain.
I liked your comment about trust yourself, and your advice to someone of 2 weeks to go for before the race is just to relax and rest up for the race, because I think that people feel that they're going to lose their fitness level in 2 weeks, and that's just not going to happen. If anything, you're going to heal from
improve.
You're going to improve. You're going to just stuff those muscles full of the glycogen, and you're going to, you know, heal up any of those little loose ends that need a little bit of repairing. One of my best races that I did, and, you know, whether it's slow or fast doesn't matter, you know, because your best race can still be slow, that I did the last week, all I did was, because my family was out of town, I slept and ate ice cream. And that's all I mean, I had to work, but at the end of the day, I went to bed early and I had a bowl of ice cream and no one was around, I went to sleep. And that worked out pretty well, and I felt great on that day.
Mm-hmm. I think the only reason that I do a couple runs the week of a race is honestly to keep my sanity. Like, I know I'm not under the impression that I'm going to lose my fitness. The work is done. Trust the work. It's honestly that I need to keep my sanity and just keep the blood flowing through my legs. So that's why I run, but during a week of a race.
You know,
or at least I tell myself that.
We're trying to talk about injuries. And rehabbing, but you can see the focus that Faith has about her race. It seems like every single detail of our injury stuff is going right to that race, which is great because it's topical, and it's important, and it's fun. So I like it, Faith, that you are focused for your race. Scott, you have a question, I see. On my FaceTime, it's a finger race, yeah.
I was going to say, Dr. Mark, what are the most common repetitive use injuries that you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at, you know, not just what I see, but the data, if you look at running injuries, it's knee, foot, and ankle. You know, so it's going to be anterior knee pain. It's going to be Achilles tendinosis, plantar fasciitis, you know, shin splints, which is really a nondescript term for several diagnoses in the lower leg. But those are the big ones that, you know, I think anyone who deals with runners or is a runner themselves has seen. Which is very telling, I think, which leads you back to running form, because if you really learn to run correctly, you know, we're relying a lot on these small muscle tendon groups So if you're running an overstride heel strike pattern, you hit the ground, you lose all your forward momentum, and then you've got to recreate it and push off again with all of your lower extremity musculature, which are not designed to do that type of stress every day. So the big movers in our body that, you know, we've evolved, you know, to deal with walking and running for hours and hours are really the muscles around our core and our glutes. Those muscles are designed, you cannot hurt your glutes. They don't tire out. You know, they don't get repetitive stress injuries. So we need to learn to use the muscles that are designed to make us run. You know, if you're a pitcher and you're constantly getting elbow tendonitis because your mechanics are bad, you know, that's, you don't throw with your elbow. Anyone who understands pitching is you're really using the big muscles in your back to throw, but mm-hmm. people don't throw right, and they start using all these little muscles and they tear the tendons off the bones because they're not throwing right. So move upstream to the big movers, you know. So injuries sometimes are a cue not just to overtraining, but your movement patterns, you know. So anyone who moves too much, too hard, too soon, too fast is going to get hurt. But a lot of people they're not doing that. They're in a good training, you know, zone and a correct amount, but they keep getting this micro trauma in these areas that just aren't designed to deal with that type of stress because they're not being used correctly. So there's so many things to it, you know, which seeing a good running doc if you're hurt is real important because you can't treat the symptoms. You can only go back and treat the causes. Mm-hmm. And they could be 6 to 10 things that add up to the injury.
You know, when you talked about big muscle groups, I don't know what if other people do this, but when I'm hiking up a big hill, I try to focus on like my big muscle groups, like using my quads, like really tuning into my quads, really tuning into using my glutes instead of like pulling, like making sure to pull with big muscle groups instead of relying on like little tendons. I don't know if you guys ever hone into that as like helping you get up like a big hill. Is that something you do or am I alone
one? I've done that for a long time. I've been an advocate of really focusing in and listening to those glutes contract. Because mm-hmm. I know that if I'm doing that, then I'm creating core strength and, mm-hmm. you know, using that big group, watching posture, keeping my torso where it should be in relationship to the waist.
And abdominals.
Oh, yeah. I can't tell you how many times I come back
to that. Like you'll come back to that 2 million times in a 50-miler whenever you get a bad patch. Is okay, go back to what you know. You'll recover.
Yeah, I come home a lot of times from steep runs with like my abs are just toast. Like I feel it in my lower abdominals and they're like sore. Hmm. Maybe that's a personal problem, but sounds like that from the look I'm getting.
What about the layoff? That people, you know, inevitably hear, you know what, you just need to take a few days off or maybe a couple of weeks off. But we just, as runners, sometimes try to ignore. We'll give that advice, but we'll never accept it or place it upon ourselves. But is rest good medicine, Dr. Cucuzzella?
Well, I think it relative rest, depending on what you did to require that rest. So for people that are just exercising for general health and constantly in the happy zone, you could run every day. That's normal and natural. You know, if you feel like you want to take a day off, take a day off. But that easy aerobic running, you know, which is low heart rate running, that's not stressful. That's recovery, and that makes your brain happy. So that's all good. If, you know, I run almost every day that if I have time to run, it just makes me happy to go outside and play. You know, it does many things for me to help reset everything. But if you're doing a lot of hard, like if I'm dealing with high school kids and they're doing really hard workouts and they don't really understand what easy is, sometimes you actually have to tell them take a day off. You know, in the way that Bill Bowerman told Kenny Moore, you know, you will not run more than 12 minutes at this pedestrian pace or I'll kick you off the team. Because they're all type A. You know, they don't know how to read their bodies yet, and they're too young. So the people that make these mistakes tend to be either very young or novice, where they don't understand how to read their bodies or, you know, kind of sense, but they just keep doing the same thing because they read a schedule, and they feel like if it's not hard, it's not worthwhile. So they have to somehow get that out of their brain that easy is a good thing. Easy has many benefits. You know, nothing should be work. And the people that are still running at age 70, they get it because they're still running at 70. You know, they're doing it unconsciously. It's the ones that just quit or the ones who never got it. You know, they kept hurting themselves to the point that, you know, a doctor will tell them running's bad for you, and then they'll accept it, believe it, and then that's it. And then they'll get diabetes and all that bad stuff.
I like that point, learn to trust your body. Be intuitive. You know, being an intuitive runner, of giving yourself permission to go easy, giving yourself permission to go hard, but just being at the moment in your training cycle. And just because it's a long run day and you're not feeling it, you know, going out there and pushing through it might be not only your body's trying to tell you to lay off and take a break. It's giving you every indication that that's what you need to do. But sometimes I fear that if I go out there and push into a very negative experience and make myself do it, maybe I won't like running as much, and it will start to become a labor and not a passion. And so I give myself, I don't want to have a psychological scar. But that doesn't mean I won't do tough things, but it just means that sometimes you just have to have intuition, listen to your body, and respect it, and become a good partner with it, a good training partner. I think you said that in the beginning, Dr. Cucuzzella. Maybe the best training partner is you.
Yeah, and that play sometimes, if you look at how you played as a kid, I mean, play at times is, you know, is fun and stressful at the same time. I mean, you're doing something highly exertional, but it feels good and it's doing something, but you're doing that naturally. So all of this isn't just always easy. At some points you just want to go and press the barrier a bit, but you'll know when that is. And when that's that time, do it and have fun and embrace it. You know, and you can't map it out on a schedule. You know, like yesterday, my friend and I, who's running the Boston Marathon too, he's a very good marathoner. You know, we started a 2-hour run and we're just goofing around and running real easy because we said, well, let's just do this one real easy. And then we both started to feel a little better about an hour in, and he started to press the pace a little bit. And, you know, we just started goofing around, and I've started to feel good, and I really started to press it a little bit. And I said, well, just, you know, practice hanging on my shoulder. You know, I would try to drop him, throw in some surge. And we were just having fun. You know, we finished the run feeling good, but we went and goofed around. I don't know what, we didn't have a watch on. We were probably running close to 6 minutes at the end, but we were kind of just almost like you're in kind of a race situation where none of us were trying to hurt the other person, but we're just kind of, you know, seeing where we're at and just having a good time with it. And knowing that this was probably the last time you'd kind of goof around with that kind of stuff before the race. But that gives you some confidence too, that you can press a little bit, relax, recover. You know, here's an uphill, press a little bit, relax, recover. That's all the art of, you know, trying to race a marathon.
Yeah, and toying with the effort level of going hard and backing off. And it's a dance. It's kind of an endurance dance.
It is.
You know, of,
yeah, knowing, having the confidence that you can go hard a bit, but if you're tired, you're not done. You know, the person who can recover best is the one who becomes the best racer. It's not the person who can surge the best. It's because everyone's kind of throwing in harder efforts, but who can actually recover off of that effort to get back, you know, to that happy place, and then, okay, time to do it again.
Right.
That's kind of how, you know, that's it. You know, that's how you run marathons, you know, to succeed in them.
And that's one of the things that I enjoy most about long trail runs, and especially when it counts. If you're on a race, then you're really have a goal in mind. You can do it on any training run, but it's just that, being honest with yourself to look and say, how can I hold this pace, or am I going out a little bit faster or hotter right now than I should? Should I back it off? It's that constant changing of that dial of up and down pace or effort, or knowing the course is going to give me a little bit in another mile so I can hold this and then take advantage of that down. I mean, there's so many cool things about this sport. I like it.
Dr. Mark, what percentage of cumulative injuries do you think are related to what we talked about earlier, being too much too early versus the whole just poor running mechanics?
You know, no one's answered that question, so I think anyone who tries to give you an exact answer is making it up, because we don't have the exact answer. You know, I'm one who really believes in the research, you know, kind of end is there's some things we know, some things we think, some things we have no clue. You know, and I think this one is one where kind of, well, we think some things because we do have, you know, data on impact forces of different stride patterns and heel strike patterns, which add different types of, we call them, you know, loading rates and impact transients. How fast does your whole leg decelerate when it hits the ground? This adds a lot of stress to the bone system. So if you get stress fractures and you're a heel striker, certainly at a certain point, if you're landing incorrectly, that load is going to shoot above capacity. But it's a combination of things. If you didn't run enough, you wouldn't have the problem. So it is both. And I don't think anyone will ever be able to define it's one or the other. It's an everything thing. So people that move correctly and progressively increase their fitness don't get hurt. I mean, when you were a kid running around in your bare feet for miles and miles and miles, did you ever have an overuse injury?
No.
No, you would somehow you would just stop. Yeah, you wouldn't. I don't know. I mean, my kids have never come to me and said I have Achilles tendinosis or something. They run around more than I do.
I'd be impressed if they did.
Yeah, well, they don't say, you know, I got this pain in my foot, you know, because, you know, for one, I'm not like telling them to play soccer 5 days a week. If they want to play, great. But they're not forced to run laps around the field more than their body tells them they should. But yeah, it's both. You got to have, it's like all repetitive stress injuries. Our bodies are designed to move in specific ways. If we move away from that, it goes against evolution. I mean, not to get all paleo wacko about it, but you know, the body is designed to move in a certain way. That's long ago we started doing that. Now we change our patterns. You know, put a shoe on someone and it changes how they move. Is it better? I would doubt it because it's new. Why would it be better? It's not better.
Oh, I like that. And I also like paleo wacko.
But yeah, everyone's like, oh, this is some fatty paleo thing, you know, like move the way your body's designed to move back in caveman day. You know, well, what's so weird about that? You know, go over to Indonesia, they don't land on their heel when they run.
Right. This may be on the
fasciitis.
This may be on the same general wavelength of having fun and too much too early and whatnot, but seasonal cycling when it comes to training, do you believe that an individual can train with high intensity year-round, or is there something to be said for training really hard through the spring and the summer and then kind of decreasing it during the winter? Is it possible to train at a high intensity all year-round?
No. Period. Good. Yeah, physiology and history bears that out. So if you're talking about training hard and adding anaerobic work, you know, meaning high intensity interval training, you can get an adaptation in 4 to 6 weeks off of whatever base you have, but you can't sustain it. So again, like, you know, if you're an NCAA competitor and your meet is in June, you're going to time your most high intensity stuff, you know, that's going to adapt you for that anaerobic work, you know, 4 to 6 weeks out. You're not going to do races in the middle of your base period. It makes no sense. It's going to inhibit aerobic development. So if you're really looking for peak performance in a shorter anaerobic type event, you know, even 5K down, you know, 10K down, if you're a competitor, you're going to periodize where you're going to build the base, start to add strength, coordination, speed, and then finally anaerobic work. But if you're like 99% of people that you just want to be well and healthy, you can run all year round with that aerobic level running, you know, that happy running. Now, if you have a couple key races, so for example, I have like 2 or 3 races every year that probably matter. The rest of it is just for yucks. So the Boston Marathon in 2 weeks. So I'll do all mellow, easy running, and then maybe 8 weeks out, I'll start to add a little more speed play. You know, I'll start to pick up the pace on my longer runs a bit just to feel, you know, that marathon race pace. But I won't be doing marathon race pace work 3 months out. It makes no sense. You know, you'll leave it on the table 2 months before your race. You just have to trust it. Most people don't have the confidence to trust. They feel like they have to run faster than what they need to do on a race situation every day. And then they show up and they always have, you know, quote, bad races because they don't, you know, they don't get it. It's everything you do has to have some purpose to get you to where you want to be. And if it, it should not be hard, it should be, you know, a gradual adapted stress, but should never be hard.
I've credited before on a podcast, Brad Kearns, who's a triathlete up here and has a nice resume of great success at an elite level. And he talks about that very thing, building that huge base and then going out and racing it. But he says you can't race, and you can't race with consistency if you don't have a large base. And go out there and run it 70% of your effort, and build that big base, and then go tear it up on race day.
Yeah, just read any of Arthur Lydiard's stuff. So back in the day, you know, when his runners were running, they had 3-month track seasons. So without that base, so what they would do is, you know, they build the base, and then they do these short periodizations for specific meets. But that base kind of drove them through a 2 to 3 month track season. So they weren't like, you know, one race and done type of runners. They would run race after race after race. After, like John Walker would run 24-minute miles in a season. Phenomenal.
Wow.
You know, how did he do that? You know, because he had such a massive base that he was constantly, you know, okay, we'll just mellow out a few days. You know, and his coach kind of knew how to time that. But they were always like, you know, it's kind of like the axe thing. You know, if you're going to chop down a tree, you know, how are you going to do it? Do you want to have a really small, sharp axe, or do you want to have a big, big, big blunt axe? And which is going to be able to chop down more trees?
I'm going sharp.
I'm going blunt.
You're going small and sharp?
I'm going long, yeah, because of the torque.
Yeah, you're going big and blunt, because that thing will chop down a bajillion trees. That really small, sharp one might be able to get one, and then it's done. You know, it's toast.
I can edit that out.
Faith is on it. You know, big blunt axe.
I use a chainsaw.
Yeah, power tools. Scott's into power tools.
You know?
Dynamite. There you go.
We're going back to caveman stuff with the blunt axes, but.
Mm-hmm. And everybody's a little bit different, Dr. Mark. You know, some people are just different. You know, have different genetic characteristics, and we
totally
have to, you know, be intuitive with what we have. Some people are sports cars. Some people are Mack trucks.
I'm a Mack truck. I'm designed for comfort, not speed.
Oh,
yeah, that's a great point, too. If people want to really get better, sometimes you have to embrace your weakness. So if you know that you just love running all day at this easy pace, but you actually want to get better, have some fun and start doing some sprinting. You know, you got to train for what you don't know sometimes, and
mm-hmm.
that's the only way you're going to grow and discover. So
mm-hmm.
do things sideways,
advice.
Do things backwards, you know, do things that aren't completely in that comfort zone.
Well, great. Dr. Cucuzzella, as always, you know, our time flies by quickly. We started off with the topic, and we could probably we could probably go back to that same topic next time and have a completely different podcast.
It's a running smorgasbord.
Don't run too hard. When it hurts, stop. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you have a big race coming up in 2 weeks, and we won't talk to you until after that event. So good luck at Boston.
See how it goes. I'll report back on if. You know, every year is a different adventure. That's the beauty of it. It can go well, or, you know, I could be, you know, heaving my guts out at the top of Heartbreak Hill. We'll see what goes. Hopefully not.
How is your preparation?
My 20th Boston.
Year?
It's kind of as it always is. Is, you know, it's part of my day, and it's fun, and I feel healthy. So see what the weather's like and go out and seize the day.
Now when a man owns a shoe store, you know, what shoe do you wear going to this event?
Yeah, so I mean, I have a pair of Newton MV2s, which I use. They're very thin, light shoes, and you know, they're great for, you go faster in shoes than barefoot, you know. So I wear shoes when I race 26 miles on the streets, and those are very firm. They're not mushy shoes, so they work well for me. I've worn them in 3 marathons, and yeah, I'll do some of my longer, harder training runs in those, just to get adapted to that shoe. Do a lot of barefoot running. If I'm trail running, I'll use something that's very much more proprioceptive, very skinny and thin, and yeah, mix it up. So it's using different things to work different muscles, but I love that Newton MV2 to race a marathon in, and it flies on the road.
I gotta tell you, between our last podcast and our podcast today, I went to go visit my family in the San Francisco area, and I saw a gentleman running on the street. He was a heavier guy, and he was with a pretty fit-looking guy, and they were running on the pavement. And I looked down, and they were barefoot. And my mom goes, What is that guy doing? He's running barefoot on the pavement. And I look over at the heavier set guy, and his big toe is totally cut open, bleeding, but he's got a smile on his face, and he's running. They're running barefoot right around the San Francisco Bay Area on the training run. They look like they're having a good time.
I haven't bled yet running barefoot, but maybe he's got neuropathy or something.
But I wanted to say that your message seems to have made it from Virginia to San Francisco.
Causing
people to cut their feet. Yeah. No, running barefoot.
Yeah. Everyone can learn something from running barefoot, you know, about how you land and, you know, how your body adapts to different surfaces. So it's all the experience.
And they can learn from your video out there. And that's, again, it's linked at our site at naturalrunningcenter.com. And like you had said, it's not necessarily about running barefoot. You show the videos because you can understand better how the foot strikes the ground when there isn't a shoe on it. So that's why you're showing us barefoot running. If you're going to run into things that are sharp and there's glass, like that gentleman there in San Francisco, maybe you should put some shoes on. There's a reason that we have jackets. When it's cold out, we need to put them on so that we don't freeze to death.
If there's frost on the ground, I got my shoes on. It's cold.
There you go. I mean, the things have been invented over time for a good reason, and shoes might be one of them. So, Dr. Cucuzzella, good luck in Boston. We'll hear a report from you, and we know that it will be successful just based on your training and your experience, and you know how to negotiate that distance. So best of luck to you.
Excellent. Well, as always, and Faith, good luck.
Thank
Rock
you very
on
much.
And feel the love out there.
Thank you.
just know this, Faith. When you cross the 26.2 mile marker,
yeah,
Dr. Cucuzzella is done with his race. You still have some more to go.
Yeah, these ultra things, you know.
I'm marathon, ready.
I'll be at the beer tent.
Well, good. You two will have to exchange some war stories on the next podcast.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah, we will.
Trail Runner Nation.
They call it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Trail Runner Nation member, make sure that you go to trailrunnernation.com and get on the forum. In fact, there's a space there to give Faith some advice or any other 50-miler runner some advice of what your experiences are. We can be found at We Are Nation on Twitter. And Facebook, I've blown this a couple times, I'm going to say Trail Runner Nation. Just go to Facebook, put in Trail Runner Nation, and look for the Cocopelli. The Cocopelli. Scott, have you sent Dr. Cucuzzella a Cocopelli?
No, I can't recall.
Oh,
I don't
well.
Think so. I think I'm looking for – I think you need to send us your address, Dr. Mark.
Oh, I'd love a Cocopelli if it's something for good luck.
Oh, it's more than luck. It's a performance-enhancing Cocopelli, and it's a temporary tattoo, and it's our the Cocopelli that you see on the Trail Runner Nation logo.
And it's totally legal.
And it's legal, right? It can't be screened.
It's not doping.
It's not doping. And there's just one caveat. You want to make sure that you place it in the direction that you're running. That's important. And beyond that, make sure it's exposed to the elements. Wind, sun.
Sweat.
All of these things will enhance its properties. So we've done a podcast on it. We brought in the Dr. Nelson, who was the it might be an internet doctoral degree that he has. I'm not sure. But
it goes from Peru.
Peru? And he got it overnight.
Underground.
And he's done a lot of studies on it.
I may use it in Boston in a couple weeks. Yeah.
We'll get it to you. And we'd be proud to have that Cocopelli run through in, in the two-hour some change time. That would be wonderful. So we'll get those to you, and you can let us know how the Cocopelli enhanced your marathon.
Cool.
All right. Thanks, Doctor.
We'll chat in next month.
You got it. Thank you very much. Burns into the grill.
Show.